In Santa Cruz, California, 95063. And please make checks payable to KFVR. But don't forget to mention a time for prayer. And then for personal prayer requests and correspondence, write to A Time for Prayer, P.O. Box 2032, Crescent City, California, 95531. Again, that's A Time for Prayer, P.O. Box 2032, Crescent City, California, 95531. Thank you for standing with us, and may God bless you exceedingly abundantly above all you're able to think or ask. Amen.
Thank you. Well, good evening. This is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers. And, of course, if you're out there across America listening to us, we will always welcome your calls at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls for the time being, because we have with us in studio this evening Colonel Craig Roberts, and we're going to be talking about, well, all sorts of exciting things. The first hour, we're going to be talking about his book, Killzone, A Sniper Looks at Dealey Plaza. Colonel Roberts, thank you so very, very much for being with us this evening.
Well, I'm glad to be here, Stan. You know, we've talked about this before in the past, but it's always interesting to go back and revisit it, because we have to look at the powers that were involved in the Kennedy assassination sometimes to understand what we have going on today and how things can be manipulated and covered up and made to look like other people really did something that they may or may not have been involved in at all.
Well, I think that really we can learn so much from looking at the Kennedy assassination, trying to understand what happened on the 11th of September of last year. If there is a force in the United States so powerful it was able to conceal the murder of an American president, it would have to have been somebody who was able to manipulate the intelligence agencies of our country, the Federal Bureau of Investigation, control a large part of the media, and actually be able to deceive, at that time, you know, close to 250 million Americans. Now, if they could do it at that time, could the same thing be happening today? So how did you get interested in the Kennedy assassination enough that you were willing to study it and then eventually to write a book about it?
Well, you know, for some of the listeners that may not know who I am, at that time I was a Tulsa police officer in Oklahoma. And I was also at that time flying helicopters for the police department. And I had to go to Dallas in 1989 for a law enforcement convention in Arlington. And the law enforcement convention for helicopter pilots, for police helicopter pilots, lasted about 3 or 4 days. And on the third day, I had the afternoon off. I really didn't have to be any place, so I thought I would just kind of drive around Dallas a little bit, look the area over, and see what was going on. So I got a map out. I had about 4 hours to kill. And I wasn't very far from a place called Dealey Plaza. Well, I remember exactly where I was the day Kennedy was shot in 1963. That was the crime scene of the century, and I'd never been there. And I'd written books about other things, military history and so on. I was a Marine sniper in Vietnam, and I had written books about Vietnam and about sniping and so on. And I thought, well, you know, I'll just go over there and see what this place looks like, because Oswald was supposed to be a sniper who shot the President of the United States at the time. I was in high school when this happened. I remember the day quite well. I think everybody that was alive then, old enough to remember it, knows exactly where they were on, you know, that day in November 1963. So I got to Dealey Plaza, and the first thing after I parked the car that I noticed was it's a lot smaller than I thought it was. It's a kind of a triangular-shaped area. There's three streets that enter, and then they go under a triple overpass, so to speak, or underpass, and exit the area. And the Texas School Book Depository is on the northeast corner of this triangle. Now, allegedly, according to the history that we've all been fed, Lee Harvey Oswald, the lone nut with a gun from the sixth floor of the School Book Depository from the far eastern window, shot Kennedy, who was riding in the back seat of a car that was absolutely full of people. There were six people in the car. And he was going down the hill, around a bend, and through the trees on the street in front of the School Book Depository, westbound in the motorcade, when Oswald shot him. For those that don't know too much about what happened that day, the crime scene, supposedly, we'll kind of recreate it here in just a second. But first, I walked around Dealey Plaza, and I looked at, you know, the various areas around there, and then I went up into the sixth floor, which is what had just been turned into and opened up as a museum to the Kennedy assassination. And I walked around, and I read all the displays and so on. You know, Oswald did it, and so on. And there's only one out of all of this displays that were up there, there was only one that talked about other people being involved or conspiracy theories and so on. It was kind of off in the corner by itself, and it was very, very vanilla. It didn't go into any detail on anything. And I didn't have any dog in this fight. I really didn't care too much about it, other than the fact that, you know, Oswald did it, then Ruby killed Oswald, then Ruby died of cancer, case closed. Well, I got over to the sixth floor window, and it was closed off by glass, but you could stand at the window right next to it and see the same field of fire, so to speak. And I looked out that window, and I could see instantly that the government had lied to me, that LBJ had sent us to Vietnam and got 58,000 of my colleagues killed. I spent a year in Vietnam thinking that this government, you know, I was fighting on the side of right and so on, and here we had a government that absolutely lied and continued to lie to the American people. The textbooks lied to the American people, because there's no way that Oswald, from that position with a 6.5mm Carcano bolt-action rifle, could have pulled off world-class shooting in the way he did. Now, the reason I knew this, obviously, was because I couldn't do it. I couldn't do it with my Model 70 Winchester with the inertial scope I had in Vietnam. And I didn't know any of my friends that could have pulled off that type of shooting, putting you know, 3 to 4 rounds downrange in 5.6 seconds with that bolt-action rifle, with two of them actually striking Kennedy. And the last one being a fatal headshot at 88 yards at a downhill angle, when Oswald didn't even know that there was such a thing as a formula for shooting at a downward angle or for shooting at an upward angle, because the bullet doesn't fall the same if you shoot downhill as it does if you shoot level on the range or if you shoot uphill. And he'd only fired level at the range. He didn't know the formulas for shooting downhill. And the only reason we knew is because we were in the hills in Vietnam, and we would shoot down after we sighted our weapon in on the range and miss the target. Couldn't understand why until we found out that the bullet doesn't drop as much if you shoot at a downward angle like he had. He had about a 40-degree downward angle. We also knew that if you fired at an upward angle, the bullet dropped more because the gravity had more of an effect on it. They didn't know that in those days, so there was a fallacy right there. And as I started to examine this case, I saw more and more fallacies as the thing went along. Now, here's what the government alleges that happened that day. That that Oswald is in the window, and I go into this in the first chapter of Killzone in quite a bit of detail. I put you in the place of Oswald, what you would have to do that day with that weapon to pull off this series of shots. Oswald is in the window. He's looking down at the street, and there's a street that comes straight at him off of Main Street. It comes straight at him and then does a 120-degree turn and then starts going away from him. Well, the limousine comes straight at him, and he waits until he can see the target, which is Kennedy, in the back seat, clear of the windshield, because you had the windshield, then you had you know, the governor of Texas, Connally, and then you had Kennedy behind him. But when the limousine turned, it came almost to a full stop right under the window, and that would have been the time, if Oswald would have done it, he should have taken his shots. He didn't do that. It was a perfect shot. The distance, there's no way he could have missed. He waited until the limousine continued on westbound on the street. As it started on westbound on the street, Kennedy was hit first in the throat from the front, if you look at the Zapruder film. And then if you continue to watch, and you know, when Zapruder took that film back in 1963, he was an 8mm camera, they didn't have any inkling that in this day and age we would have videotapes of that film, and we could put it on the VCR in anybody's living room and do fast forward, slow motion, back up, pause, and just really examine this tape and dissect it. So I just happened to have a copy of that, and when I got back home after this trip, I ran it several times and I looked at it. Kennedy gets shot in the throat from the front. He puts his arms up in the air, and he grasps at his throat, and he's got a look of surprise on his face. Then there's a missed shot. Then there's a shot that hits him in the back and drives him forward. Then Connally is hit, completely separate shot, from the right, from the western window of this Texas School Book Depository. It hits his right arm. It hits him behind the ribs, and then hits his right arm and deflects off into his leg. Then Kennedy is shot from the front. So there we have the throat shot, we have the back shot, we have the miss shot, we have the Connolly shot, and then we have the head shot. That's five shots right there. Then they have another one that cracked the windshield of the car. We don't know where that one came from. So we have at least five shots, if not six, that we know happened. Now, allegedly, Oswald had three empty cases in the rifle at the on the sixth floor when it was found. There was three empty cases on the floor, and then a loaded live round in the chamber of the weapon. When Lieutenant Day picked up the weapon, the bolt was handle was up, but there was a live round still in the chamber when he pulled it back. But this rifle holds six rounds. It has a clip that fits inside the rifle. And when the last round is chambered, the clip falls out a hole in the bottom of the magazine well. There was no clip that was found. So now we have a missing clip. Now, some people come along later and they say, well, the Warren Commission shows a clip in the Warren files and so on. Well, you can enter evidence anytime you want to if you can do it, you know, after dark. I mean, that doesn't carry a lot of light. Of all the photographs they took of all the stuff that was turned in and all of the evidence sheets, there is no clip. That beside the point, that means he would have had to single load each one of these rounds in 5.6 seconds, which is impossible. Besides that, it's a six-round weapon, but there was only four rounds accounted for, the three empties that were found on the floor and the one that was found in the chamber. So I guess it was a sporting event that day, and you're not allowed to carry more than four rounds to the assassination scene or something. I'm not sure. But anyway, that's all we had at the scene as far as cartridges were concerned. So now we've got this weapon that is extremely inaccurate. It's hard to work the bolt in a rapid manner. It had a scope on it that was aligned off to one side because of the way you have to charge the weapon with a clip. The scope was on the left-hand side of the weapon. The scope wasn't even sighted in. And when the FBI tested the carbine later at the FBI headquarters, they had to re-shim the scope mount just to get it on target. So obviously he didn't use the scope. He must have had to use the iron sights, because if he did use the scope, he would have missed entirely. Even though he allegedly sighted the scope in at a rifle range, a few weeks prior to this, according to FBI 302s, the FBI reports talking about the eyewitness that saw him at the range. So we start running into all of these fallacies. Well, at this time, it was pretty obvious to me that we had a gigantic cover-up of what really happened. But I just wanted to make sure, so I picked up the phone after I got home, and I called a good friend of mine who's featured one of my books, One Shot, One Kill, Gunnery Sergeant Carlos Hathcock. Now, a lot of the listeners may know that Gunny Hathcock was one of the highest-rated Marine snipers in Vietnam, him and Chuck Mahaney. Hathcock had 93 confirmed kills and 300 actual kills, of which 93 were confirmed, and was the chief instructor of the Marine Corps Scout Sniper School at Quantico that was set up under Major Dick Culver back at the end of the Vietnam War. Carlos is a legend in his own right. And I said, Gunny, I said, I just got back from Dealey Plaza, and I looked at this this whole Kennedy shooting scene down there, and I explained what I saw. And before I gave him an impression of what I thought about anything, I said, have you ever looked at this thing at all? And he laughed, and he said, we took a rifle like that at Quantico, and we tried to recreate what Oswald supposedly did, and I couldn't do it, and none of my instructors could do it. Now, if Hathcock couldn't do it, and the sniper instructors in the Marine Corps couldn't recreate what Oswald did, obviously Oswald didn't do it. So that left a big open gap. If he didn't do it, who did? And as I started to research into this thing, I set it up to work it as a murder case, a simple homicide. And I started reading all of these Kennedy assassination books to do some background research. Well, what I found out was we had a myriad of authors out there, all of which are basically just researchers and writers. They're not investigators. And they came up with different books and different theories, and their entire book did nothing but support their particular theory. The Mafia did it. The FBI did it. The CIA did it. The Texas oilmen did it. The anti-Castro Cubans did it. The pro-Castro Cubans did it. The Russians did it. You know, by the time we got done, all of the people who did it couldn't fit in the Super Bowl. The problem was, a lot of them had a lot of good facts, and a lot of them had a lot of good motives for these various groups to try to go after Kennedy. The thing was, though, they couldn't answer one question. And that one question was the key element that I had to look for in my book, Killzone. and that was who had the capability, not just then but now, who had and has the capability to pull off assassinating the president by setting up professional assassins to do the job, because we know the shots came from the front and the rear. Not just who were the shooters, but who controlled them, who paid them, who got them out of there, who destroyed the scene, who intimidated the witnesses, who killed off over 100 witnesses in this thing, or people that had something to do with the case afterwards over a period of several years, and who had the ability to control the entire investigation, control what reports got saved and which ones got shredded, and over 2 million documents that were put into sealed archives, who had the ability to seal those reports and keep them locked up until the year 2029. Well, the FBI couldn't do it. The CIA couldn't do it. The president can't even do that because presidents change, administrations change, directors of the FBI and CIA changed through the years. Congress couldn't do it. They don't have that kind of power and wouldn't even care. So there had to be something higher than Washington. There had to be something that could control mafia assets, Cuban assets, because we know both of them were involved to a certain point. We knew that when we started digging into this thing, that somebody had to be able to handle the money factor and control the investigation and control all of the agents. And when we put this whole thing together, we came out with two things. What was the motive? Number one, why did they want to kill Kennedy? And number two, who was able to pull it off and control the whole thing until today and beyond, until the year 2029 on a lot of these documents, even though some of them were cut out. They had an assassination review board that was put together during the Clinton administration. They were allowed to look at a lot of documents and so on. They obviously couldn't go through all of them, and I'm sure that they didn't even get some of them. And if Oswald, the lone nut with a gun, was a nobody, then how come he was a paid informant by the FBI and had an FBI informant number? And how come there was over five filing cabinet drawers of personnel file just on him? When we start putting all of these things together, we got a problem here. Well, when I started digging into this thing, I started studying Oswald, and I met with his wife, Marina, who's a very nice lady, and spent a lot of time with her, and I started digging up into some of the old records and things, and what we basically found out was Oswald wasn't just one guy. There were two Lee Harvey Oswalds that we know of. We'll call one of them Lee, and we'll call the other one Harvey, just to keep them separate. Lee Harvey Oswald, the American, was born in the United States. He grew up in Fort Worth, and then he spent some time in New York City in Brooklyn, and then he spent some time in New Orleans. He didn't graduate from high school. He was kind of a neighborhood clown and a schoolyard cut-up, happy-go-lucky kind of kid, and so on. He got into the Civil Air Patrol in New Orleans, and an interesting guy that was one of the officers in the Civil Air Patrol was an airline pilot named David Ferry, who comes into play later on. David Ferry was a CIA asset. David Ferry had flown guns into Cuba when they were setting up the guerrillas to take down, or when they were supplying Castro to overthrow Batista, and then later the guerrillas to fight against Castro. He supported the Bay of Pigs operation. He worked for a guy named Guy Bannister in New Orleans. Guy Bannister is a FBI agent who turned into a CIA type and set up a private detective agency as a front on Camp Street in downtown New Orleans. Of which later on Oswald was associated with when one door to the same building became the Fair Play for Cuba Committee, when Oswald decided that he was going to become a communist. Basically, Oswald gets recruited while he's in the Civil Air Patrol at the end of his high school years to join the Marine Corps by David Ferry. Well, they didn't need Lee Harvey Oswald. What they needed was Lee Harvey Oswald's birth certificate, his American background, and the fact that he looked like somebody else that they needed to put into the intelligence system. Now, we're going to have to tell a World War II story to bring everybody up to speed as to who Harvey is, the other guy. At the end of World War II, the Russians approached Berlin from the east, And the Americans approached from the west and overran Western Europe. A lot of things happened in those last days of 1945 in the European theater. And one of them was that the Germans were bailing out as fast as they can in the rat lines and the Omega system, trying to get them in Operation Paperclip and so on, trying to get these different Nazis out of Germany and to get their assets and their stolen booty and so on. They were all trying to figure out a way to survive the war and get out and not end up in a POW camp or tried for war crimes or shot by the Russians or whatever. Well, during this time, there was a Russian general named Reinhard Galen. And Galen was in charge of all intelligence operations of armies east, which was Russia and, of course, the Balkans. And Galen bailed out of Berlin and took 11 truckloads of documents and microfilms with him of all of the information he gathered on the Russians with the intent and purpose to make a deal with the Americans. And instead of heading west, he headed south, and he got into Austria, and he ran into a captain named Boker, John Boker. Now, Boker, a field grade officer, is not somebody that's going to capture a German general. His entire staff and all these documents, and without picking up the radio, calling his colonel and say, "Sir, guess what I've got? Why, what a good boy am I? Let me bring you what I've got here. I've got a German general and truckloads of documents." He didn't do that. Instead, he diverted this entire column, and they hid these guys out until Alan Dulles could take over. Now, Alan Dulles was the CIA station chief in Bern, Switzerland at the time.
Right, he would be OSS.
OSS, I'm sorry. Right. OSS. OSS station chief in Bern, Switzerland at the time. And this deal had already been made. It was cut and dried before Galen ever left Berlin. So he ended up able to hide Galen until they could have meetings later on to determine what they were going to do, at which time Galen became an asset for what later became the CIA in 1947, after the National Security Act of 1947. At the same time this is going on, they've got another operation going on, because they're trading prisoners, and Russians had taken over all of the POW camps that were in the Eastern European countries, in Poland and the eastern part of Germany, that held Americans and British and Dutch and French, where the Americans had taken over the camps that were in western part of Europe that held mainly Russians, Red Army soldiers, Yugoslavians, Hungarians, and so on. Because the Germans always transferred their war prisoners as far away from their friendly forces as they could and put them on the opposite side of the theater. At the end of the war, Stalin wanted all his people back, and he didn't want them back because he wanted to bring them home to Mother Russia. He wanted them back so he could take them out and shoot them for being captured, as an example to everybody else, because in the Red Army, you didn't surrender, you didn't allow yourself to get captured, you fought, or you died. That was it. That was your choice. Now, these guys knew it, and they didn't want to go home. At the same time, Eisenhower wants the American troops back that Russia's got, and we got several liberated POW camp personnel back, but there's 26,000 that we know of that Stalin held. So what happened was Stalin finally said, if I don't get all my people back, you're not going to get yours. And he started moving them farther away from the front. He started train loads of American prisoners going into Siberia until such a time as we would come around and give him all these Red Army prisoners. When we forcibly loaded prisoners aboard trains and took them to Hungary to exchange them with the Russians, we had to do it at bayonet point. Many of them committed suicide before they even got on the air or on the trains. When we got to Hungary, there's one instance that I recount in my book, The Medusa File, of which they unloaded these Red Army prisoners who were marched down into a quarry, an open rock quarry, and the Americans were offloaded off a Russian train, put onto the American train, so to speak, to get ready to be taken back into France, when they heard machine gun fire. And the American prisoners were told, don't look over there, don't ask any questions. The Russians had machine gunned that entire train load of Russian prisoners right there in the quarry and were waiting for another train to arrive. So that's kind of what was going on at the time. While this was going on, Stalin was real adamant about getting one particular batch of prisoners that we had, and that was the SS Galician Division. Now, the SS Galician Division was a Ukrainian division of Russians who were with the Nazis. They fought with the Germans against Stalin. They were white Russians. They didn't like Stalin. They didn't like communists. So they sided up with, it was either fight for one side or the other. They weren't going to fight for the Red Army, so they sided up with the Germans, and they were made into an entire SS division. And they were, you know, bloodthirsty people. They were, just all through the war, they were very, well known for being able to go in and just destroy villages and kill people and so on. They became prison camp guards and so on. But they took their families with them. So they had not just the soldiers, but they had the wives and the children that traveled not too far behind. They surrendered to us at the end of the war because they didn't want to surrender to Stalin because they knew they'd all be killed, men, women, children, the whole bit. Well, Alan Dulles spirited the Galician division out of their cantonment areas and smuggled them down into Greece. Then from Greece, they went to Italy, and from Italy, they boarded ships, and when it was safe, you know, a few months had gone by now, they brought them over to this country, they brought them in through Canada, and took them down into New York at first, and that became the White Russian community that's now in New York City. Then elements of them were taken, and they were taken to the Fort Worth area, and they were also taken out into New Mexico. Well, some of the people that Oswald grew up with and later met in the Fort Worth area were White Russians. The De Morenschilds were White Russians. at this time...
Now, just for our listeners, De Morenschild was really Lee Harvey Oswald's handler. De Morenschild was CIA, and of course he was Lee Harvey Oswald's closest friend at the time of the assassination.
Right. Now... one of the reasons that we wanted the White Russians over here was Dulles had convinced Truman that we could utilize them as assets against the Russians, the Soviet Russians, the Stalin bunch. And we could take their teenage sons and train them to become spies for us because they spoke Russian. And we could take them and parachute them back into Russia or smuggle them across the lines and let them get back into Russia and report back because they were Russians. We had our own spy network that we could hook up with the Galen organization that now became the intelligence gathering organization for the Bundeswehr in Germany, in Western Germany. And it would be just great. The problem was the Russians weren't stupid, and they captured almost every single one of these guys that were sent over there. So we had to figure out another way to smuggle agents into Russia. Now, one way to do this, they found out, was defectors. If we had American defectors defect to Russia, then the Russians would take them in, and you know, after a period of time and gain a little bit of trust, maybe they would be able to maneuver around and serve as spies. Of course, the Russians expected them to probably be spies at the same time. So we had to be very careful how we did this. The most successful program that they came onto, that they discovered, that worked the best, was to have defectors be American service personnel, guys that knew military secrets. And if we allowed them to share some of these military secrets with the Russians, then the Russians were only too glad to get them. They had to prove themselves over a period of time, but the best way to do that is have somebody who would claim to be a communist, claim to be anti-American, disenfranchised, etc., etc. Now, that is called, in the espionage world, building a legend. What they had is they had a White Russian, we'll call him Harvey, his name may be Alex Heidel, we don't know. I think his real name probably was Alex at one time, and I don't know what his last name was, because Alex Heidel turned out to be an AKA name for Lee Harvey Oswald. It was on one of his draft cards and so on. So we've got Alex Heidel, AKA Harvey, who is a Russian from his dad was probably in the SS Galician division, and he's in Brooklyn, New York, and or somewhere in New York City, and he's been recruited by the CIA with several of his friends. He's going to be taken into Russia sooner or later, or at least allowed to defect to Russia as an American serviceman. But to do this successfully, he can't go in there as a Russian American. He has to go in there as an American American, somebody that grew up here. So what we need now is somebody that looks kind of like him, that we can use his birth certificate, his family, and his background. So when the KGB checks, they can follow him all the way back to the day he was born in Fort Worth.
Well, we're going to have to take a 3-minute break here, and so as soon as we get back, we're going to hold calls because we want to get this amazing story for you. We'll be right back here at Radio Liberty. Well, All right, so we're talking about his book, Kill Zone, and of course, all of Craig's books are available if you're interested in knowing more about them. The books are Medusa File, The Dead Witnesses, and of course, Kill Zone, and if you'd like to learn more about them, why, you can call 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. These are some of the finest books you'll find on really any subject, because Medusa File covers everything, TWA, downing of TW-800, the Oklahoma City bombing, the men we abandoned in Vietnam, so much, and of course in Korea and at the end of the Second World War. Tremendous amount of information in the Medusa File, but this right now we're talking about Kill Zone, of course the story of the Dead Witnesses. Over 100 people who were associated with the Kennedy assassination or witnessed one or another aspect of this died under very, very strange circumstances in the years following the assassination, the murder of an American president. Who had the ability to do that? Who had the ability to cover that up? All of these books are important, and we hope that many of you out there will want to get the information. And again, if you're interested, you can call 1-800-5-HIV-WAR for more information. And then, of course, we want to remind you that Radio Liberty is listener-supported. If you're out there listening to our program and you believe that you're going to hear information on Radio Liberty you won't hear elsewhere, we hope many of you will decide right now you want to join the Radio Liberty family of supporters, because that's how we're able to do what we do, 5 hours a day, bringing the information that Barbara Walters, Dan Rather, and Tom Brokaw paid so much to conceal from the American people. And if you'd like a free copy of our newsletter, our latest newsletter, of course, deals with the fact that between 1955 and 1963, why 98 million doses of the Salk polio vaccine were given to the American people, and of course they contained SV40, a cancer-producing virus, and they couldn't let the American people know that. And of course, this is really an amazing, amazing story. It's been suppressed for 40 years. We'll give you the documentation, the sources where you can check this story out. And of course, this is so important today because they're passing legislation in every state across America to force you to be vaccinated. Now, if they would lie to us about the polio vaccine that we took back between 55 and 63, and of course, if you get this month's newsletter, the July newsletter, you'll find that they lied then about the next set of vaccine, the Sabin vaccine. But if they will lie to the American people about that, what else will they lie to the American people about? And how have they managed to keep this up? Well, actually, a good article did appear just a week ago, pardon me, just last Friday, the Wall Street Journal in the second section. If you haven't seen that article, we'll be glad to send you a copy of it. Remember our telephone number. It's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR, because truly America is under attack today. Well, Dr. Stan back here, and our special guest this evening is Colonel Craig Roberts, and I'm going to let you, Craig, tell you the rest of this incredible, incredible story. And of course, this is all documented. These are things he's been able to find out as an investigator, and can document. I've followed his career for many years, and I can assure you that he would not put out anything without having thoroughly investigated. So, Craig, why don't you go ahead and pick up the story?
Well, we have the two characters we're following right now. We've got Lee Harvey Oswald, who didn't even graduate from high school, and he's recruited through the Civil Air Patrol to join the Marine Corps by David Ferry. We have someone else who speaks Russian, who needs an identity that is American. He needs a birth certificate. He needs records that go all the way back to the day he was born, because if he defects to Russia, they're going to make sure that he's who he says he is. So David Ferry evidently was contacted, and many other CIA agents were contacted to look out for someone that's, 17, 18 years old that looks like, this particular description. And Oswald just happened to fit the bill. It could have been anybody else, as long as they looked like this guy. That's all they needed, as it was a background. So both of them joined the Marines. Well, Harvey goes to boot camp at Paris Island, more than likely, and I'm having to speculate to fill in the blanks some here. Having been in the Marine Corps just shortly after this myself and going through the same training, I know how the system works. Lee Harvey Oswald goes to boot camp in San Diego, Marine Corps Recruit Depot, San Diego. He graduates from there. He goes to the infantry training regiment up at Camp Pendleton. Now, all through the 11 weeks of boot camp and the 4 weeks of ITR, infantry training regiment, where you learn to shoot all the weapons, you stay with the same guys. You're with the same 60, 70 guys that are in your platoon. You all get to know each other very well. At the end of that 4 weeks, however, you get your orders to your assignments out in what we call division, which means going out to the seven winds. And so Oswald gets his orders, and here's a guy who did not graduate from high school. And this put red flags up for me. And none of the other Kennedy investigators or researchers knew this because they weren't in the Marine Corps. If they'd been in the Marine Corps, they would have seen some serious problems right at this point, the real Achilles heel to the entire case. Oswald didn't even graduate from high school. That means he would have had to get a waiver to get in. His mother, plus his age, at 17, he had to get his mother to sign for him to get in. He would not have drawn an inter-service school. He would have gone, and he would have become what was known as an 0311, which is basic rifleman infantry, even though he only qualified marksman on the range. People say he didn't qualify. Well, he did qualify, but he only qualified marksman, which is the lowest of the three shooting grades. He ends up getting and drawing, instead of infantry, there on Camp Pendleton, toting a rifle, he draws an inter-service school, but not just any inter-service school. He draws radar control school in the Air Force, which that is a plum at the top of the tree. That's not something you just send anybody off to. This is the pick of the litter goes to this place. So he goes to Mississippi to an Air Force base, and he goes through this school with the sole intent of purpose of becoming a U-2 radar operator in Japan. That's where it's geared for. But it's not Lee Harvey Oswald that arrives at this school. What has happened at this time as we put this thing together is we think that our Alex Hydelsky, Harvey, the guy, the Russian that went through probably Camp Lejeune and Paris Island and so on, met with Lee Harvey Oswald someplace, and all they had to do, it was so simple, all they had to do was they had two what we call SRBs, service record books. The Army, they call them 201 files. It's your personnel file. The only things they had to do was take Lee Harvey Oswald's personnel file, pull out his fingerprint cards, pull out his dental chart, and pull out his photograph, and then substitute it with Alex Hydelsky's. They put in his fingerprint cards that say Lee Harvey Oswald at the top. They put in his dental chart with Lee Harvey Oswald at the top. And those are the only physical, biological identifiers in the service record book. So he takes the Lee Harvey Oswald file and the Lee Harvey Oswald dog tags, and he goes to the Air Force base and reports for school as the only Marine going through from the West Coast. And he successfully goes to this school. But now we have to look at what happened to the real Lee Harvey Oswald that was born in Texas. Well, we have records. And I was at this time I was working with a man named John Armstrong, who helped me co-author the book The Dead Witnesses. And John was his whole investigation centered around who's Lee Harvey Oswald and where was he every single day of his life. And he worked this case like a lawyer. What he did was what we call a chronological detail survey. Now, a chronological detail survey is you take and you fill in on a long chart all the dates you know where somebody was at. And you can plug them in there. You know that they went to school at such and such an elementary school from September of 1954 to May of 1956 or whatever. You plug in all these dates. We know when he was in the Marines. We know when he was born. We know when he was in elementary school, et cetera, et cetera. Well, John did this, and as he's doing this, he starts sending off FOIA requests, for Freedom of Information Act requests to the government on things on Oswald, and he gets these tax records. And guess what? We have Lee Harvey Oswald paying income tax with Lee Harvey Oswald's Social Security number by the name Lee Harvey Oswald in New Orleans working for the Riley Coffee Company at exactly the same time that Lee Harvey Oswald has been being sent to Japan to be a U-2 radar controller in Japan. So we know now we got him in two places at the same time on record. And we have the Marine Corps record showing him also at Japan at exactly the same dates that he is in New Orleans working for the Riley Coffee Company, according to their records. So now we know we got these two guys. Okay, now The one that goes to Japan is the one we're going to focus on, because this is our Tim McVeigh. This is the guy who is going to be sheep dipped. He's the one that's going to develop a legend and turn into a spy and go to Russia. Well, he's already a spy, but now he's going to be put into his mission, and this is, it's a very specific mission that I'm going to give you. He goes to Japan. He's there controlling the U-2 flights. This is the key to the whole thing. When he's in Japan, all of a sudden he speaks Russian, he reads Russian newspapers, and he starts talking to guys in the barracks for the very first time of being a Marxist, being a Russian, or being a communist, I mean. And he's going to, he starts telling people that, Uncle Sam's bad, and the United States is bad, and we ought to become socialist, and we ought to become Marxist, and it's so much better. And what he's doing at this time is he's developing a legend. A legend is where you can leave tracks to where when people start checking on you, they can go back so far and say, yeah, we'd interviewed this guy, and he said this guy told me he was a Marxist, 5 years ago or whatever. Oswald, after he gets all of his training and finds out everything he needs to know, that we know that we can put him controlling U-2s, and the Russians can put him controlling U-2s. They can check in Japan and find out that he's controlling U-2s over Russia. He draws emergency leave to come home because his mother, who's working for Dolly's Shoe Company, drops a box of shoes on her head that she picks off the top shelf, and it bounces off her head. Now, we all know a box of shoes doesn't weigh anything, and it's not going to hurt you. But that is the excuse they use to bring Oswald back from Japan on emergency leave because his mother got a knot on her head or something. Interesting thing happened to him in Japan, by the way. When we looked at his service record book, his 201 filing, his health record, he had caught gonorrhea. And the doctor wrote it off as in line of duty. Now, that is the one and only time in the entire history of the United States Marine Corps that entry was on the health record with gonorrhea, because it was a very serious offense to catch a venereal disease. They would, in the Marine Corps in those days, and then even afterwards into the Vietnam years, if you came down with something like that, the chaplain would notify your family. If you were married, he would notify your wife. That's how serious it was, and they let you know right up front. You didn't want to mess around with this stuff. So here he gets it, and they write it off in the line of duty, and he gets no punishment. So we knew there was another problem there. We follow this guy. He gets home. He visits his mother one day. And Marguerite is his mother. He visits her one day, and later on she said, he sure didn't act like my son when he came home. So evidently he did look a lot like Lee Harvey Oswald. He goes to New Orleans. He's down there just a few days, and then he goes to New York City, and he gets a passage on an ocean liner, first class, all the way to England. Ends up in Europe. He's staying in very nice hotels for a couple of weeks over there, really partying up, and then he defects to Russia.
Now, wait a minute, but he would be AWOL? AWOL?
Well, he would be, except they don't show him that way yet.
All right, fine. So here's a guy who abandons, really. He's sent home on emergency leave. He takes off, defects to Russia, and he's not AWOL? I mean, how could he not be AWOL?
Well, when he defects, of course, then they stamp him unauthorized absence, and then eventually absent without official leave. But he goes to Russia, and the Russians accept him. Now, what has he got to give the Russians? This guy is a kid from Texas that doesn't know anything. Oh, but he does know something. He knows something the Russians want real bad, because he was put in the position to get it. And that was this. He got to Russia, and he gave them the one thing they needed. They had overflights of U-2s flying over Russia all the time. But they couldn't shoot them down because they didn't know the altitude they flew at. They could figure out the course, they could get them on radar, but they couldn't judge the altitude. MiGs would take off and try to intercept our U-2s, but they would flame out before, 10,000 feet below they'd ever get to the U-2s. The U-2 pilots used to look down and call them an aluminum cloud because of all the MiGs they would send up, and they would just tumble back toward the earth after they flamed out. And so the Russians were having a very difficult time, and they were losing a lot of face over this because Stalin, then later Khrushchev, was very adamant about shooting down any American airplane that flew over Russia, but they couldn't touch us. It was like slapping them in the face. So they wanted to shoot down a U-2 real bad. They wanted to stop these overflights. We're flying out of Peshawar, Pakistan also, and Francis Gary Powers took off 6 months after Oswald got to Russia, and for the first time, they had a missile go and blow up right behind the tail of his aircraft, and it threw the U-2 forward to where it broke off the wings. It went into an inverted spin, and Powers almost didn't get out. He did manage to get out, and he did manage, of course, to get captured, and we know that the Russians took him in and held a trial and for espionage, and then they ended up training him for an East German spy that we had captured, or at least the Western Europeans had captured. So I think his name was Abel, if I remember right. So here's Oswald over there, evidently was the guy that was able to provide them with the cruising altitude that we were flying over Russia with the U-2, so that Powers could get shot down. Now you're going to say, wait a minute, why would we want the Russians to shoot down one of our airplanes? Well, we call this thinking ahead of the jet. What was also happening at that time is that the Skunk Works at Lockheed had developed a new reconnaissance aircraft. Actually, what they had done is they had developed a long-range bomber interceptor. It was known as the A-12. Now, the A-12 was a one-seat aircraft, and it was had two big engines. It flew very high, very fast. Flew as fast as a 50-caliber bullet. You know,
that's the Blackbird, is it?
It was originally called the A-12, and right. It was a fighter interceptor. And what happened was right behind the cockpit, there were two doors that would open up, and a Hughes missile would come up on a rack, and a launching rack right behind the pilot, and they could fly out to sea, intercept Russian intercontinental bombers, fire this missile off, and shoot down a bomber, and then fly back. Now, and we could get them far out of range. You know, as soon as we could detect them, we could be out there before they were to ever get in range of launching anything to us, because we're talking, you know, nuclear World War III here. The problem with that is the Russians didn't have any intercontinental bombers. The biggest thing they had at the time was a knockoff of our B-29. They'd captured one of our B-29s during the Korean War, or maybe it was World War II, but anyway, they took it apart piece by piece, and they started building, the Aleutian people began building an identical replica that I think it was the IL-2 or IL-4, but anyway, it looked just like our B-29. Well, it wasn't going to be any threat to us over here, but they did, even though they had intercontinental capability with it was slow compared to the jets we had at the time. However, for reconnaissance purposes, the A-12 would have been ideal. The Air Force wanted a version that they could put two seats in. And they wanted a pilot to just fly the airplane. Then they wanted a reconnaissance officer who would sit behind the pilot and operate the sensors, the cameras and the various other sensors they had on board, the electronic intercept stuff. This aircraft needed to be funded, and the CIA had no funding. The Air Force didn't have funding for it because the Air Force had a high-altitude reconnaissance airplane called the U-2. The only way that they were going to get funding for the A-12 was to, which the Air Force version was going to become the RS-71, because of that it was going to be reconnaissance and surveillance, and it was going to, and then the number 71. The only way they could get that is if they could show that the U-2 was obsolete. And the only way they could show the U-2 was obsolete is if they got one shot down, because we're talking a multi-million dollar project that was going to last 30 to 40 years. This was the most advanced airplane in the world, and is still probably one of the most advanced airplanes in the world. It's one of the fastest jets ever built, and it's not really even a jet. It's more of a rocket ship. It's a spaceship. It's an incredible piece of machinery, way ahead of its time. But to build this thing was going to cost money to get it out to the Air Force, and then the CIA wanted their own version, and they kept the name the A-12. And so there are single-seat A-12s still out there, still flying missions, because they can be used, launched, send over a target, and brought back very quickly, unlike a satellite that has to be maneuvered over a period of time to get over a target. So an SR-71 can do point reconnaissance, where a satellite has to do area reconnaissance, and if it's going to do point reconnaissance, it takes a lot of work to get it there. They say they retired the SR-71. Maybe, I don't know. I'm not sure, you know, if they really retired all of them or not. But the when Johnson announced that we now had a replacement for the U-2. See, we had to stop flying over Russia. Eisenhower made a deal at SALT agreements with Khrushchev that we would quit flying over Russia after the U-2 was shot down. and the American aircraft would not overfly Russia anymore, and we shut down overflights of Russia, which time we lost all contact with what was going on down there because we didn't have any satellites in those days. When, of course, Eisenhower was gone, they started to do it again, but this time they were going to do it with the SR-71. Well, Johnson got up, and when he announced that we had this new airplane that was a replacement for the U-2, he called it the SR-71. Even though on his speech card it said RS-71, he misread it, and he said the SR-71. So instead of correcting the president and saying the president made a mistake, they changed the name of the airplane instead, and it's been the SR-71 ever since, which is kind of an interesting little side note to that. And it became the Blackbird, the Lockheed Blackbird, because it was painted black. So now we've got Oswald over there. He's of no further use now to the Russians. I mean, he gave them the only thing they needed, the only thing we wanted them to have. And now he needs to actually get out of Russia. But he can't just leave right away. That would throw everything, you know, into kilter. So they put him up at Minsk. They put him into working in a radio factory. And that's where he meets Marina. That's where he marries Marina. He hangs around in Russia for a period of time. Other things go on that we don't have time to go into with Oswald. But we need to get him back home. So he ends up going, he renounced his citizenship. He was this communist, this defector and all that. But when he decides to come home, he goes to the American embassy. They hand him a passport. They give him $400. They give him tickets for him and Marina, and they put him on an airplane and they send him home. Now, I've never heard of that happening to anybody else before or since.
You mean somebody who's defected, who's denounced American, suddenly you give him a passport, you bring he and his wife back again? Yeah, I've always wondered about that, and I think if anybody with half an ounce of intelligence knows that Lee Harvey, or whatever his name was some sort of a government asset.
Well, he had to be. He had been sheep-dipped. He had a legend. He had a profile. He did everything according to Hoyle. Now he comes home. What are they going to do with him? Okay, he's done his primary mission. Well, they moved to Texas, and they're down there for a while. Then they move to New Orleans, and they're there for a while. Then they move back to Texas, and so on. Well, while he's in New Orleans, he gets into this Fair Play for Cuba committee, because we're at the same now. This is the time we're getting ready, to do battle with Cuba. We've got the JM Wave set up at the operation at the University of Miami South Campus, and there in Florida, and it's run by Ted Shackley, who's a big time CIA agent, and his assistant chief of station is Tommy Kleins, and then under them they've got the ZR rifle team and so on. They've got Operation Mongoose and Zapata, and they're getting ready for the Bay of Pigs invasion and all this sort of thing. Well, at the same time, in New Orleans, we've got a Cuban training camp on the north side of Lake Pontchartrain that Guy Bannister's involved with and David Ferry's involved with. And now here we got Lee Harvey down there. And he is the only member of the Fair Play for Cuba committee. And he's got an ID card, and he's passing out pamphlets, very crudely done pamphlets, 544 Camp Street, Fair Play for Cuba committee, and so on.
In other words, he's creating the impression that he's a communist or pro-communist.
Right. Now, he went to Russia and was a communist, and then he didn't want to be a communist anymore, so he came home. But then when he came home, now he's a communist again. He's a Marxist. He did an interview on television. Here's a nobody who gets an interview on television in New Orleans in those days, and he's telling everybody, yes, I am a Marxist. He wants it in the record. He wants everybody to see it. This is like McVeigh handing out the Turner Diaries. You know, I mean, it's pretty obvious that you're building a legend when you're being so obvious about, here I am, the communist or the anti-government agent or whatever. He does this. He even gets in a fight with two Cubans, free Cubans, anti-Castro Cubans, on the street right out in front of the building, and that gets filmed, and that gets put on the air. So now here he is, ready to go, pro-Castro, I'm a communist, you know, I hate everybody, et cetera, et cetera. Now, he's being told to do this. We know that. But why? He doesn't even know why yet. He doesn't know what he's involved with. But he is actually, they don't need him anymore. What they need to do is, now they've got a situation where they're going to try to get rid of the President of the United States. We're having a fast forward here. We're going forward in time. And they need somebody, so he's the ideal choice. He's the throwdown guy. He's the patsy. Now, people say, well, this is kind of far-fetched. That's kind of a real conspiracy stretch, you know. I mean, what's going on here? Well, they haven't read the material in those days, the assassination manuals and so on, that had to do with how do you do an assassination and get away with it and make somebody else look like the perpetrator. Well, there's different ways to do it. And one of the ways was set somebody up to be the patsy, do the assassination, but leave all the evidence on them and make sure they get caught. And then they don't have any way to talk their way out of it. They take the fall, and you get away scot-free, especially if there's an entire team working. All you need to do is have one throwdown guy that's expendable.
Like James Earl Ray
or Jack Ruby.
Right.
So if you've got these guys, Timothy McVeigh and Nichols, you know, throwdowns. They're low echelon, low level. They serve their purpose, and then we'll just do away with them. So that's kind of where we went with Oswald. Now Oswald ends up in Dealey Plaza, and he's hanging out with George de Morenshiel. And the next thing we know, he's got a job in the Texas School Book Depository, and he's living. He's got his own separate apartment, not too far away, and he's working, you know, moving these books around up on the upper floors and so on. He orders a mail order rifle, but guess what? He didn't order that rifle. And to this day, they're not sure who did order that rifle because the records are really messed up on this. It was ordered at a Klein's Sporting Goods from a magazine ad. It's what we're told. We don't know if he ever even saw this magazine ad, but it was shipped to A.J. Heidel and arrived in Dallas and so on in a post office box. But what was real interesting about the rifle, when we start looking at it, it's like the truck axle in Oklahoma City that mysteriously, it falls in the middle of the street, and it's got a VIN number that they trace within a matter of minutes to this rental agency in Kansas. The rifle, we have to remember that Kennedy was shot on Friday at 11:30 in the morning, Central Time. They found the rifle before noon, okay? It was turned over to the Dallas Police Department. The Dallas Police Department started working on the crime scene, but they didn't really start looking at the physical evidence, the rifle and the pistol and so on, you know, even after they caught Oswald. They didn't really start looking at that stuff, so the FBI picked up the rifle, and they fly it to Washington. They write the serial number down. They start doing an investigation on it, but this was on a Friday. Well, it was late Friday night before they ever got the rifle out of there, and by Sunday, they had traced this thing on a weekend from where it was imported in the United States to Klein's Sporting Goods in the days when we didn't keep records of this stuff, to A.J. Heidel, a.k.a. Lee Harvey Oswald, through the post office system before the age of computers, the age of records.
We're going to have to say goodbye to our listeners up there in the great state of Washington, but it sort of reminds me of within 2 days of the attack on the World Trade Center, they knew the names and they had pictures and they knew the histories of all those people involved in the September 11th attack. These coincidences, you just wonder how they could not have any idea who they were, what was going to happen. And in 48 hours, they know who they all were and their histories. Well, good night, and we'll be with you again tomorrow evening. Well, good evening. This is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty. Dan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and once again bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you that the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests. And this evening, we're just going to continue along with Colonel Craig Roberts. Now, he's written the book, Kill Zone, and really what we've been talking about this last hour is all in that book. He's also written Medusa File, and we'll be talking more about that this hour. He's also written The Dead Witnesses, and it's the background of, I think, about 109 people who were mysteriously killed or died, all of them tied into the assassination of John Fitzgerald Kennedy. You've got to have a pretty well-organized group to do that. And, of course, you had a pretty well-organized group to conceal what was known that happened on September 11th from the American people. What was known beforehand? Well, we actually have an article out of USA News. It appeared just one day, and it said that there are 350,000 documents the CIA has turned over to the Senate Intelligence Committee, and they show that the CIA had infiltrated al-Qaeda, and they knew what they were going to do, and they knew they were going to hijack planes and crash them into the World Trade Center. That's front page USA Today. Appeared one time. You'll never hear that again. Why? Because think of the implications if that would be true. Why, that would mean that we left those people in the World Trade Center and the Pentagon to die, and we didn't interfere. And it's a federal crime. If you know there's going to be a crime committed, you have to try to stop it. Well, let's go ahead with this story, because now we're getting into the background leading up now to the assassination of President Kennedy. Almost 40 years ago. He was killed in 1963, and this is the year 2002. It'll be 40 years next year, and of course, it was. You have to have a very, very powerful organization that is able to control the FBI, the CIA, the Congress, to certainly the media, and ultimately control what the American people think and believe. So pick up the story from there, Craig.
Okay, so we've got Oswald, who has proven to be the fall guy for the Kennedy assassination. They've got him in custody. They take him to jail. Everything's copacetic so far, except the problem is they won't give him a lawyer. He's asking for someone to step forward to represent him. He says, "I didn't shoot the president." You know, now if he was this fanatical Marxist communist or whatever, and you would think he would say, "Yes, I got him, but I did it for Mother Russia or whatever." He would have probably taken credit for it if that was true. But he says, "I didn't shoot the president." And then he made another statement. He said, "So I'm the patsy." And it was a matter-of-fact statement. So I'm the patsy. Now, he knew that the assassination was going to go down. He knew that there was going to be a patsy. But when the shots were fired from the sixth floor, he was down in the break room on the second floor. We know that for a fact. We know that rifle probably wasn't even fired that day. We know that the empty cartridges were probably thrown up against the wall by somebody had them in their pocket, because when you shoot a rifle out a window, the Carcano type rifle, and you pull the bolt to the rear, the cartridges fly to the right and behind you. They don't fly forward up against the wall. Hardly any rifle will throw cartridges forward. So they were probably just planted there. And there's so many other discrepancies that we could go into that we don't have time to, because we need to get on with the story. But what we saw unfold after that was just insane. We've got them in a secure environment. They're going to transfer him over to the county jail and from the police department. And here we have Jack Ruby, who walks down a guarded ramp without being seen, walks right up to where the ambulance is or the transfer wagon is, and they bring Oswald out in handcuffs. And Oswald and Ruby know each other. Oswald had dinner at Ruby's Carousel Club, and we've got witnesses that saw him together, on other occasions. All kinds of evidence in that area. We have Ruby just pulls a gun out of his pocket, and right in the middle of all the policemen that are surrounding Oswald, point blank range, shoots him in the ribs, and almost instantaneously kills him with a .38 snub nose. Of course, they haul Oswald off. Now they arrest Ruby. Ruby is now in jail. And when Johnson starts the Warren Commission, he gives Earl Warren the warning that, we've got to find this guy guilty. We don't want to start World War III, whatever that's supposed to mean.
No, I think that, a lot of people at that time thought that this was a communist plot. I mean, certainly all the evidence had been created to give the impression that Lee Harvey Oswald was a communist or pro-Castro. And I think that's probably what he meant.
Right, and also at the same time, you got to remember the Bay of Pigs invasion. If we continued on this vein, we could. The Bay of Pigs invasion was over. We could go back and assault Cuba because they killed Kennedy. That's another motive that's been thrown around out there. So we've got Ruby in jail, and now he's saying that they're coming in. The doctor is coming in and injecting him with cancer cells, and everybody laughs about that. And they said, "Oh, you're crazy! They wouldn't do that. There's no such thing. This guy's a nutcase." Well, when Earl Warren and some of his commissioners came to Dallas to interview Ruby, Ruby told them that, "You get me out of here. You get me to Washington, and I'll tell you what really went on. I'll tell you everything I know." And of course, they didn't take him to Washington. They just turned and left him there to twist in the wind. And the next thing we know, within a few months, he comes down with cancer. And then he, of course, dies of cancer. Case closed. End of story. Dead men tell no tales. And then everybody knows, LBJ came along as president. We ended up in Vietnam and so on. Kennedy was pulling this off out of Vietnam. And everybody says, well, that was the reason, if the CIA or anybody else was involved, it was because Kennedy was pulling us out of Vietnam. Well, we found out some other things that were going on. Yes, Kennedy was pulling us out of Vietnam at 1,000 troops a month, or was going to. He had written a national security action memorandum. that he was going to pull us out of Vietnam, and it's 1,000 troops a month. And this memorandum came out in October of 1963. Of course, he was killed the next month. And as soon as LBJ got into office, he issued his National Security Memorandum 273. Kennedy's was 263. This was 273, putting us in Vietnam. It's 3 pages long, and I reproduce both of these memorandums in the back of Killzone. Both of the documents are there, as are other documents as well. And you can read them for yourself. And the one that Johnson issued the day after Kennedy's funeral not only put us back in Vietnam, but it increased our troop strength. It told State Department what to do, CIA what to do, USAID what to do, and so on. And it basically got us into the Vietnam War, you know, irregardless of the Tonkin Gulf incident. But one other thing Kennedy did that was totally unacceptable to the establishment. Now, we have to go back to the original question. Who could pull this off and then cover it up to the year 2029, no matter who's in the White House, no matter who's in Congress, no matter who runs the FBI? It had to be somebody outside of Washington and above Washington. Did such an entity exist? Well, when we started work in that case, we found out that there was such an entity, and they did have the capability of doing all of this stuff. And it goes right into the hands of the globalists. There's an organization known as the Council on Foreign Relations is one instance that is a offshoot of the Roundtable Group out of London, and they are able to control just about any politician in Washington. And most of Kennedy's staff and most of the presidents since the 1920s have been Council on Foreign Relations members. Now, does that say the Council on Foreign Relations had Kennedy killed? No, it doesn't. It's just one organization that we know about that can control the branches of government, but by controlling its members within those branches. There are other organizations out there as well. The capability of chasing down exactly which one was involved is hard to do without a huge staff and a lot of money. But the bottom line is we know that these organizations exist, these secret societies exist, they are able to manipulate governments, and this government had been manipulated. And we knew that Johnson was being manipulated. We knew that he was being manipulated from several different areas, including the Texas oil branch and of course the CFR and all the rest of those guys.
Well, it's really very interesting. Craig, if you read Johnson's book, The Vantage Point, he talks about a group he called the Wise Men, and there are either 10 or 11 of them, and all but one of them just happened by accident to come from the Council on Foreign Relations. Mm-hmm. The book, The Vantage Point, and anybody who wants a copy of that page will be glad to provide it for them.
And I would encourage anyone to look at the Wise Men. In fact, there's a book called The Wise Men, but if you just look at John J. McCloy, now I did a whole chapter on the guy they call the chairman, John J. McCloy in Killzone, and you can read what this guy did. Now, most people don't know who John J. McCloy is, but when you start putting together everything this guy did from World War One on through World War Two, he's the one that set up the war crimes tribunals for in Nuremberg for the Nazis. He's the one that made sure that they were all tried in Nuremberg, and then he decided what Nazis would be tried and what Nazis wouldn't be tried, and he also decided which ones would get the death penalty and which ones wouldn't, and all of his old business friends and so on obviously skated on the deal. They got out and went to Argentina. He's the one that worked up the rat lines that got a lot of the Nazis out. He's the one that later became the High Commissioner of Germany, HICOG. He also became president of the Chase Bank. He then was the first president of the World Bank for Reconstruction. And then he went to Germany and decided what places in Germany would get the reconstruction money. He's the one that decided that the Japanese Americans on the West Coast would be picked up and put in internment camps. He set up the team that broke the Japanese code. There's so many things he was involved with, and he was the head of the Council on Foreign Relations at that time. And then later, where do we find him again? This guy shows up again as a member of the Warren Commission, as one of the investigators, just right out of the blue. And there's so many other things he was involved in. And I go through his whole biography in Killzone, if anybody's really interested. And he's just one example. You got Avril Harriman, you got Alan Dulles, and all the, you know, when you start, John Foster Dulles, you start putting all these people together, and you had the power elite of the Eastern establishment all in one place with Kennedy, and then later with Johnson. And then after that, even some of them stayed on. So you had this team that really ran this country and probably ran most of the world as well. So we had all of these things going on. So because of the time constraints tonight, I want to really jump over and fast forward to the Oklahoma City bombing, because I want the listeners to understand that the Oklahoma City bombing case was a off-the-shelf blueprint operation that follows the Kennedy assassination right down the line. It's incredible the parallels we ran into, and in fact, I've written about this in various articles, because I saw the same things happening over, and I would not have seen that when we worked the Oklahoma City bombing case had I not looked so hard at the Kennedy case. You know, I started seeing history repeat itself. Now, to remind the listeners, I was a Tulsa police officer at the time. I retired just in 1997 after 26 years. I served basically in every organization within the police department at one time or another, from SWAT to undercover to patrol division to flying helicopters and so on. I was asked by the Tulsa office of the FBI to come in and help with the case on the third day after the bombing, because I had intelligence assets that they couldn't get. There's no way they could get to some of my sources or have the sources that I've got. In fact, most of the information that the FBI gets, they pay for. They have paid informants and so on. So when they get someone like me that has other resources they don't have to pay for, they love that. And they asked that I would do what I could to find out anything I could about the Oklahoma City bombing case, and specifically that I would try to find out everything I could about Timothy McVeigh, because they didn't hardly know anything about this guy on day three, other than they had him in jail in Perry, and they'd picked him up and they were transferring him down to Tinker Air Force Base. So I got involved in the case, and I started doing investigation on it and pulling in assets and favors and so on. And we found out a lot of things about McVeigh, but what I started finding out was two things were happening at the same time. We had McVeigh, who was a blueprint copy of Lee Harvey Oswald right down the line. And we'll talk about him first, and then we'll shift over and we'll talk about how Dealey Plaza and Oklahoma City crime scenes were handled almost exactly the same. And how the witnesses were handled pretty much the same. We've got, several Oklahoma City witnesses now that are dead at a very young age from strange accidents and suicides and so on. But we may touch on that if we have time later. But let's just look at the parallels between McVeigh and Oswald. You've got McVeigh and Oswald, grow up in the United States, very pro-American, very patriotic, good red-blooded American, hard-charging kids. They go into the military. And Oswald joins the Marines, McVeigh joins the Army. McVeigh distinguishes himself in the Gulf War. He's a Bradley commander, gunner, and so on, and gets a Bronze Star over there. And evidently gets recruited somewhere along the line while he's in the Army. He ends up back at Fort Riley near Junction City, Kansas. And at that point, somewhere along the line in there, he gets recruited for Special Forces, or he volunteers for Special Forces. More than likely, he was one of these hard-charging kids that I kind of think he probably volunteered and wanted to, you know, become a Ranger or a Green Beret, which is Special Forces. And he passes the test, and he goes to Fort Bragg. Now, this is where it gets a little – this is where we really start running into the problem of government cover-ups and lies, because when I started working on McVeigh, I got a hold of the provost marshal's office at Fort Riley, trying to track down when was the last time he was there, and their records showed that he was AWOL. He was absent without leave, and had been for a long time. They didn't, missing. Well, then when I called Fort Bragg and talked to them, depending on what day of the week it was and who you talked to, he showed up there, but he didn't pass the physical training test. Or he showed up and he passed the physical training test, but his feet hurt too bad and he couldn't make it through the course, and he quit and he went back to Fort Riley. Or he showed up and his back hurt, bothered him too much, and he couldn't carry a pack. Now, this guy was in the peak of health. He was an infantry NCO. He was sergeant of the month and sergeant of the year and all this kind of stuff. And now his feet hurt. After all his time in the infantry, his back can't carry a pack anymore at his young age. See, this dog don't hunt. And I'm an infantry officer. I know what it takes to you know, in this area, and I'm also special forces qualified. So I know that didn't happen. He had to pass a preliminary PT screening examination before he ever went to Fort Bragg, and he had to be accepted to go to the qualification course. So he goes to Bragg, but he doesn't go through special forces training. At this time, this is where everything got murky, and he disappears. Now, he is not shown as AWOL from Fort Riley at this time. He's shown as at Special Forces Operations School. But Fort Bragg shows that he didn't get into the school. So right in between the two places, he disappears. You go to Lee Harvey Oswald. He leaves Infantry Training Regiment at Camp Pendleton, and he doesn't show up at the radar school, but his alter ego guy shows up at the radar school with his records, the white Russian kid. Lee Harvey Oswald, that was in Fort Worth, shows up in New Orleans as a civilian out of the Marine Corps working for Riley Coffee Company in a standby hold mode down there. And he thinks he's playing James Bond. He's, you know, everybody in those days, you know, they wanted to be a big super spy and all this, especially these young kids. All right, now we've got McVeigh goes up to as a civilian, and now by this time he's sheep dipped and he's shown to be a civilian, and he's supposed to be. Now remember, now he's allegedly AWOL from the Army because he didn't go back to Fort Riley. He goes to work for Calspan Incorporated in Buffalo, New York. Well, while he's at Calspan Incorporated, number one, you have to have a clearance to work there because they handle black projects. They handle a lot of government projects. He ends up not just working there. He ends up working there as security, which means he had to pass a security screening background check to get a clearance. Well, you can't pass a background check if you're AWOL from the Army because you're on the wanted list. The FBI's got you flagged for pickup to return to the Army. So we know that he's not AWOL. They may show that as the official version, but he was not AWOL from the Army. He was on special assignment, but now he's a civilian. Now, we call that being sheep-dipped. You're in the Army, but you're not in the Army. Your records go on, your pay goes on, your time and grade goes on, your promotions continue. This is, to give you an example, we did this in Vietnam. We took a lot of Air Force guys, and we took them out of the Air Force in Vietnam and made civilian radar operators for them and put them at Lima sites over in Laos along the Laotian border on the Laos side as civilians because we couldn't have American military personnel out on these sites. We didn't have any Air Force personnel on top of these mountains running radar for our jets going into North Vietnam, so they had to be civilians. Yet when they came back after their year or so in Laos, all of a sudden they were back in the Air Force. They didn't lose any time in grade. They'd never been out of the Air Force, and they got promoted. So really, we call that being sheep-dipped. So here's McVeigh up in Calspan. Now, remember, we had Oswald in New Orleans, and he was, of course, first time we had him in Japan, and he was telling everybody that he was a Marxist, and he was reading all this Russian literature, and he was speaking Russian in the barracks, building a legend. We've got Lee Harvey McVeigh, I call him, up in Calspan Incorporated, and he starts telling these security guards he's working for about being a constitutionalist and about militias, and he starts reading the Turner Diaries and giving away copies of the Turner Diaries, which is a very inflammatory racist type of little booklet. And he establishes a legend up there of being this this radical right-wing anti-government type, you know, pro-militia and all this kind of stuff, back before anybody even knew anything about militias to speak of. And then he leaves Calspan Incorporated. He travels around the country. He always seems to have money to get from one place to another and stay in a motel. He always has money to have a car that runs, not a very good car, but it's always one that runs. He doesn't have anything fancy. But if we look at Lee Harvey Oswald, Oswald never had anything fancy. You know, you couldn't run around with a lot of money in your pocket because people would ask too many questions. They'd think you're either running dope if you don't have a job or something, or somebody is supplying you with money, and that would probably be the government, maybe the FBI, who knows. So these people that in these circles that you want to infiltrate wouldn't want to talk to you if you're too, you know, you show up and all of a sudden you don't have a job, but you're pretty well off on being able to take care of yourself. Oswald was the same way. Oswald had to stay in rooming houses. Oswald had to eat dinner at friends' houses. Oswald never had enough money to do anything other than pay his bills. Even when he wasn't working, though, his bills got paid. Here's we've got Timothy McVeigh doing the same thing. Now let's stop for a minute because we got two players here. Let's switch over to Nichols. Now we got Nichols, who is, I think, it originally was one level above McVeigh and still is. Nichols is making trips back. They met in the Army. They were friends. And now at this particular time when McVeigh's running around the country trying to get into militia meetings, and going to gun shows and trying to meet various people in what we'll call the right-wing establishment or the militia groups or the patriot groups or whatever. He's trying to get into these, but he's making such a hard effort at it that he's being recognized as somebody that's just a little bit too radical. He's the guy that wants to, hey, let's go do something right now. Let's don't talk about it. Let's get guns and march down there and take the place. You know, I mean, that's just the way he is, and they're all going, hey, we don't want this guy around here, and they keep throwing him out. During the investigation, when we started working on this militia angle that the ADL and Morris Deeds came up with, it doesn't have anything to do with the real case, we never got any place with it because there was no connections. There was no connections between McVeigh and any militias or right-wing organizations or anything else. He was pretty much, according to the FBI report, a loner, just a drifter, other than Nichols being his friend. But Nichols, at this time, when McVeigh's running around trying to establish a regiment, you know, remember we had Oswald, he was down on at 544 Camp Street in the Fair Play for Cuba Committee handing out leaflets. We got McVeigh running around the country handing out Turner diaries and getting in fights and so on. It's an identical scenario, and I'm seeing this thing develop right before my eyes. We got Nichols. What's he doing? He's going back and forth to the Philippines. He's not only going back and forth to the Philippines, he's going to Manila, and then he's going to Cebu City on Cebu Island. Well, Cebu City just happens to be the home of Middle Eastern terrorism in the Western Pacific. It was the home of Ramzi Yousef. It was the home of Abu Sayyaf. Okay? Not only do we find out here just recently, and we knew that there was a Philippine connection, we knew there was an Islamic connection because of the Iraqis that were involved in the Oklahoma City bombing, which is we probably won't have time to go into today, but we know that that Nichols is going over there, and he doesn't make just one trip, and he doesn't make just two trips. He makes numerous trips. We're not sure how many trips he made over a period of time over to the Philippines, and sometimes he stayed over there a couple of months at a time. He ended up divorcing one wife. He ended up marrying a Filipino wife, Mary Ferry Torres, whose father was a Philippine national policeman. Then he brought her over here, and then he would leave her here and still go back to the Philippines, and he would have meetings over there. He called it looking for business opportunities. Well, one of the meetings that we know he had, and we've got an affidavit on, is that he had a meeting at a warehouse outside of Manila with a guy named Edward Angeles and another guy named Ramzi Yousef. Now, Edward Angeles was the co-founder of the Abu Sayyaf, and the Abu Sayyaf is the Muslim terrorist organization that's trying to overthrow the Philippine government. Abu Sayyaf is funded by none other than Al-Qaeda, and Ramzi Yousef was funded by Al-Qaeda. And all of this tracks back to a guy named, at that time, I wrote about him in the Medusa file. If you look at endnote 207 in the Medusa file, which is written back in, 97, I think, it talks about a guy named Mohammed Osama bin Laden. And that was long before any Americans had ever heard his name. This guy was deeply involved in helping fund or run the Oklahoma City bombing case. And it came out of the Philippines. And this is why our government didn't want to go that direction. They didn't want us looking at the Philippines during the bombing case. They didn't want to have any Muslim connections whatsoever because it would have led in places they didn't want to go. They wanted to go after the right wing. They wanted to pass anti-terrorist laws. They wanted to pass the Ominous Crime Control Act of 1996, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
You know, it's really so interesting. This Angeles, there's information that Angeles, who was the co-founder of Abu Sayyaf, that killed Greg Dixon, the American missionary. He was a government agent. He was a Philippine government agent. Did you hear that?
That's right. He was. He.
In other words, the Philippine government set up a terrorist organization, a Muslim terrorist organization, aimed at trying to overthrow the Philippine government. They created a foil, and of course, this was then being at least in part financed by Osama bin Laden. You have to understand that many times governments set up the enemy. So that you have somebody that you can rally the people behind the government.
Well, that's very Orwellian. If you go to, if you go back into Orwell's writing, remember that you had to have the war in Oceania You had to have everybody occupied with the war that was going on the other side of the world, so that they knew that there was something that was being done. There was a threat out there. We were handling it. The war in Oceania goes well. It's the same thing here. We have the Abu Sayyaf allegedly was set up by the Philippine government because the southern end of the Philippines is mostly Muslim. They wanted to be able to recruit and then control and identify all these Muslim terrorists. Well, how do you do that? It's very easy. You set up an organization, you have them all join it, you have the membership roster, and you know who they are, and you run the leadership. Now, the one thing you have to do is these guys aren't going to stay involved in an organization unless the organization does something. So every once in a while, it's got to go out and blow up something or kidnap somebody or do an assassination, and that's all business as usual to these guys. And we do the same thing, and so does everybody else. So it's like playing cards. You got a hand, and different cards have different values. And to them, Abu Sayyaf was one card in their hand, and it had a certain value. To it. The problem with this was you had Ramzi Yosef involved in this, and his thing was blowing up the World Trade Center. Now, what's kind of unusual is why would anybody pick the World Trade Center not once but twice? They tried to blow it up. They did a lot of damage to it. It didn't come down, and it didn't fall into the second tower and all that sort of thing back in 1993. Now we have the deal where they take the airplanes and they, of course, crashed them into the buildings and so on. But getting back to Oklahoma City, we've got Nichols going back and forth. He doesn't have a job. He spent between $90,000 and $120,000 in expenses, in travel and so on. But he didn't have a job. So who's paying the bill? Who's putting money in this kid's pocket to go back and forth and do all this stuff? Now, when the Oklahoma City bombing occurs, we've got McVeigh, who's out here. And he's, doing this truck bomb routine and so on, and they have the crime scene and all of that. And we know that that truck bomb didn't do the damage that it allegedly did, and we can get back to that after the break.
All right. Well, this is Dr. Stan. We're going to have to take a three-minute break, and we're not going to take any calls because I think you'll learn a lot more just by hearing Colonel Roberts talk. Information needs to get to the American people if we are to remain free. And remember what Jefferson had said, any nation that expects to remain both free and ignorant in a state of civilization expects what never was and never will be. And without the truth, why, there will be no liberty in America. So, of course, in a tragic situation, the fourth estate in America has become a fifth column. It's time to help get the truth out. And so 5 hours a day here through various networks, and then two programs on the weekend, we reach out across America. But quite frankly, we need your help. If you believe in what we're doing, we hope many of you will decide that you would like to join the Radio Liberty family. You may want a free copy of our newsletter. If you do, our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. And then please tell others about our radio programs. Tell them about our website, www.radioliberty.com. That's radioliberty.com. And there, of course, you're going to be able to find all sorts of fascinating information. You can get many of our archive programs. You have my permission to pull down our newsletters and to copy them. But help us to get the truth out while we still have a voice here in America. Again, our number, 1-800-5-HIV-WAR, because America is at war today. Our freedom, our families, our freedom are under attack. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and we're going to not take any calls here. I want Craig to get the story out. So, Colonel Roberts, go ahead, pick up the story from where we were.
Okay, so we're talking about the alleged truck bomb. We know that it couldn't have done the damage that had occurred to the building. We know there were charges inside the building. We know some of them went off and some of them didn't. On day one of the bombing itself, we had came across the news. I saw it live on television. It came across the news as a possible natural gas explosion under a downtown office building in Oklahoma City, and they showed this black smoke coming up from the building and so on. And as they got closer and they started looking at it, then all of a sudden they announced that it was a car bomb. And when the FBI was told that a car bomb wouldn't do this, it'd have to be bigger, it became a station wagon bomb, then it was a pickup truck bomb, and then finally, it got to be a moving van bomb because they went from 1,200 pounds to 2,400 pounds to 4,800 pounds of ammonium nitrate. Of course, we didn't find much ammonium nitrate at the scene. In fact, I'm not sure if they found any ammonium nitrate at the scene, but that's beside the point because we don't want the facts to ruin a good case. But when we look at this, even if it was an ammonium nitrate bomb inside the truck, we had a very small crater in the street, very small indeed. We have to compare it with what happened in some of the other bombings around the world. I got a briefing from Israeli Defense Intelligence on this, and they showed me videotape of various buildings that had been blown up, and almost all of them in the Middle East had been blown up by a truck that was pulled up out front. Were all done by PLO types, Arab terrorists, and so on. The IRA in England had done a few, where they left a truck with a timer or a car with a timer out in front of a building, and I saw some things that the Scotland Yard Special Branch had recorded of damage that was done by the IRA in London and in Belfast. But if we look at it as an example, the Khobar Towers in Saudi Arabia, where they took a tanker truck loaded with Semtex, which is a high explosive, and they pulled it up in front of the Khobar Towers, and they detonated it, and it left an 80-foot trench in the ground, where Oklahoma City, we had like a 12-foot hole. This thing only took off the very front facade of the building. It took out the windows. The furniture was still sitting on the various floors, and it only killed about 12 people. And this was a tremendous bomb of high explosive Semtex, which is a plastic. It's like C4. So we know that just comparing those two, that wouldn't work. If you look at the Beirut Barracks truck bomb, it was a pickup truck loaded down with Semtex, which is like composition C4, and the guy drove it through the front door into the building itself and detonated it, and that's what brought the building down, was he got the structural support columns. But the Oklahoma City case, we know that the pressure of the bomb itself, if you listen to General Parton, he knows a lot more about it than I do, and it's obvious that didn't happen. But the 6.5-millimeter Carcano didn't fire any shots that day from the sixth floor of the Dallas School Book Depository, yet it was entered into evidence as the weapon. So you've got the Ryder truck and the Carcano rifle are quite comparable as far as evidentiary use, in the sense that neither one of them could have done the job that was attributed to them with the amount or the time involved. In the case of the Carcano, the three shots in 5.6 seconds. In the case of the Ryder truck, 48 pounds of ANFO taking down a bomb-resistant, reinforced concrete building in the manner that it did, and doing all the damage that it did. So then we go back to Nichols. We've got this guy running back and forth to the Philippines, working with Arab terrorists. We know that for a fact. We can prove it in a court of law. Our eyewitnesses at the scene at Dealey Plaza would point to the grassy knoll, and they would say the shots came from there. But the eyewitnesses that pointed at the grassy knoll were never called before the Warren Commission. Only witnesses that said they think the school book depository is where they heard the shots were called to the Warren Commission. People that said that the gunfire in Dealey Plaza was staccato. It sounded like firecrackers or a machine gun. In other words, we had several shots in a very short period of time. We're never called to testify before the Warren Commission. If someone said they heard one or two shots from the school book depository, they were called to testify because that's the record they wanted put down on paper. In the Oklahoma City bombing case, if you saw more than Lee Harvey or McVeigh get out of the Ryder truck, then you weren't called to testify before the grand jury and later the trial in Denver at Judge Mage's court. If you didn't see what the government version was at the Murrah building, then you did not get called to testify. If you saw Arabs standing in front of the Murrah building wearing blue jogging suits, holding the parking place for the Ryder truck, and then running and getting in a brown Chevrolet pickup truck or General Motors type pickup truck, leaving high speed westbound on Harvey, then you were not called to testify. If you didn't see those guys there, then you might testify. So the witnesses were all manipulated. No witnesses were ever produced that went counter to the official version of the story in the Kennedy assassination or in the Oklahoma City bombing case. McVeigh gets captured just like Oswald did. He goes to jail just like Oswald did. No one talks to him just like Oswald. They don't want anybody talking to this guy. And they were terrified that someone like Jack Ruby would pop up and execute this guy or shoot him or poison his food or something. So he had super security to make sure this didn't happen again, because obviously we weren't going to buy this all over again. But they had to transfer him from El Reno to Tinker Air Force Base. They ended up, first they transferred him from Perry down to El Reno, and then from El Reno to Tinker Air Force Base, and then back to El Reno. So Oswald is making the rounds of these different jails, at which time it's all been, not Oswald, but I mean...
Perry, right.
After a while, you can't keep these guys separate anymore.
Lee Harvey McVeigh.
Lee Harvey McVeigh. So he's in jail, and they finally round up Nichols. Nichols is first arrested as a material witness, and then later they file charges on him as being an accessory. We look at while McVeigh's in jail, he is not. He's calm, he's cool, he's collected, just exactly like Oswald. It's like he knows that he's okay, nothing's going to happen, and he's going to get rescued out of this situation. Until I think at some time along the line, he finally figures that he's the patsy, just like Oswald did. And at that point, he started cooperating more with his attorney, Stephen Jones. And they started probably giving him a little bit more information about what was going on. While all these things are going on, we're still working other aspects of the case. And we know that this is going to take a lot of logistical support. Just like the Kennedy assassination had to have logistical support. It had to have means of hiring the right people and putting them in the right place on the grassy knoll and other places. And then getting them away afterwards, airplane tickets, private aircraft, whatever. We had to have logistical support base for the Oklahoma City bombing. Where did that come from? Well, we had the Philippine connection. We had Abu Sayyaf. We had Al-Qaeda. But we also got information about this time that really opened the case up to those of us who were seriously investigated, because by now the FBI had dropped out of the serious investigation of the case. They were doing exactly what the FBI did in 1963. They were running around the country interviewing all kinds of inconsequential people just to develop paperwork. They had, you know, if you generate a million documents, the defense is not going to be able to weed through all of these documents to come up with anything important. They just don't have time. It's an avalanche of paperwork. Well, they also can say, we did this tremendously huge investigation. We had 5,000 agents working on it. We spent $2.6 million or whatever the figure was, and we developed, 40 tons of paperwork or whatever. None of it really means anything unless you get to the paperwork that has the facts in it. But you don't do that by, interviewing Aunt Matilda down at the Rock and Y Ranch to find out how many times the cattle got out last week, so to speak.
And, of course, if you've read Stephen Jones' book, I know that you have, he points out, of course, Stephen Jones was Timothy McVeigh's attorney, that the FBI intentionally misspelled names. So you get a file on somebody, and you would, of course, put it into the computer, but they would misspell the name, so you couldn't figure out who this guy really was. And they did this over and over and over again, so that even much of the material that was given to the defense was useless because the wrong name would be on it.
Well, they couldn't look it up. They would run in their computers or just give them to them on disk. So they say, okay, we want to look up, Sam Jones. And if they didn't spell Jones right in some of the documents, they wouldn't be able to retrieve all the documents.
Might be Sam James or Joseph or something like that.
Yeah, or John Sam.
And they would do this over and over. So you know very well that this whole thing, somebody was telling the FBI people put down the wrong name.
Yeah, this wasn't just occasionally. Right. This was quite often. And I asked one of the agents I was working with at the time, and I said, are you guys being told to go out here and just interview all kinds of people that have absolutely nothing to do with this? They just get these names, and you're supposed to go out and do a 302, find out what they were doing that day and all that kind of stuff? He says, yeah. I said, isn't it kind of a waste of time? He says, yeah, but we have to do what Washington says. Well, what it is, it's creating a mountain of paperwork. It makes it look like there's this huge investigation going on when there's really no investigation going on. It's all being manipulated. And at the same time, they bring a team in from New York City that's their anti-terrorism task force that investigated the original World Trade Center bombing and manipulated that one around. And they came to Oklahoma City, and they started intimidating witnesses. They destroyed all the evidence at the scene by bringing the building down. At Dealey Plaza, they did that. They had a curb in Dealey Plaza that had a bullet strike on it. They dug up the curb and replaced it in one night and sent the curb to FBI headquarters, where it disappeared.
It's another thing so interesting is that I know we've heard the testimony from several people who saw what happened at Dealey Plaza, and the FBI would come and say, you didn't see what you think you saw.
Right.
And the same thing exactly happened to the witnesses in Oklahoma City. Remember the fellow who rented the Ryder truck had seen somebody else there. And the FBI agent said, no, there was nobody else here. You just think you saw somebody. Words to this effect. Now, you would think that they would be collecting evidence, not actually trying to intimidate witnesses.
Well, they would in a normal case that didn't have any political ramifications. But this one went up to very high levels because of some of the things that we found out went on behind the scenes. But they were actually changing reports, falsifying reports, and telling witnesses what they saw and threatening those that said, no, I saw two guys get out of that truck, and they said no, and you don't want to say that either if you know what's good for you. Well, that's not the way you do an investigation. That's the way you manipulate an investigation. We got information that there were two Mexican bag men that brought money out of Mexico to Oklahoma City, stayed at one of the motels, and then dressed up as Arabs for some reason, even though the people at the motel knew they were Mexican. Well, I got a phone call from somebody I know, one of my sources in Texas, who's a former Texas State policeman, and he said that he got information from one of his informants that there was a guy named Juan Garcia Abrego. Now, Juan Garcia Abrego was a Mexican drug lord. He was part of Iran-Contra. He ran one of the networks of bringing cocaine into the country that on the ground transportation side that Reed talks about in his book Compromised. Terry Reed. This Juan Garcia Abrego ran a big network at the south border of Texas. He had assassins. He had couriers and mules and so on to bring this dope across. That ended up as part of Iran-Contra during the time when Clinton was governor of Arkansas. During the time when they were flying dope into MENA, and that cuts were going out to all kinds of different areas from there on the cash flow on that. So Abrego evidently was supposed to have sent these two guys up to Oklahoma City with this money to help finance the bombing. Now, why would he do that? Well, we started digging into that, and we find out – I get a phone call from a guy who says that he is a federal agent or was a federal agent. I'm not sure which. He was kind of vague about it, and he wouldn't give me his name. And that he was in Little Rock, and that what I needed to look for was what was in the records in the Murrah building. And I said, well, what records are you talking about? He said, we sent our investigatory records from IRS and DEA out of Little Rock when the Clintons went to Washington. We sent them over to the Murrah building. Well, that jived in the sense that on day one, they shut down all rescue attempts of people still trapped in the building, and they brought in a bunch of guys with blue jackets with no letters on the back, and they brought in two military box ambulances, and they started loading records out of the Murrah building and putting them into these ambulances. And there was an FBI agent named Gene Pogue at the time. This was on the AP wire, that when he was asked, why are you stopping rescue efforts when people are still trapped in the rubble, to go get a bunch of paperwork? He says, I don't know. He says, it's unfortunate, but it has to be done. And so, you know, we have documentation that from eyewitnesses and the AP that, yeah, they stopped everything and they started pulling these records out for like 3 or 4 hours. Now, were those the records that came out of the MENA investigation? We don't know. And the reason we don't know is because they disappeared. There's no way to trace them down, no way to look at them now. But when you start putting all these pieces to the puzzle together, it starts explaining a few things to us. It explains why all of a sudden they don't want to find any Arabs in front of the building. They don't want us to track down Mexican money and so on. I went to the FBI and I said, look, I got some information here, and here's my 3-page memo I just typed up about a guy named Juan Garcia Abrego, and I don't know who he is. I've never heard of him. This isn't my area of expertise. I said, I'll tell you what. I'll leave this with you. Give me a call after you find out if this guy even exists. Just find out if there is really a Juan Garcia Abrego, and then I'll go back and look at it some more. And a day went by, and 2 days went by, and 3 days went by, and finally I called my contact agent back, my assigned handler, so to speak, and I said, hey, what'd you find out about this Abrego character? He said, oh, it's all hokum. And that's the exact word he used. It's all hokum. He says, the guy doesn't exist. No such animal. I said, really? Okay, fine. And so I let a month or so go by, and I called my contact down in Texas again, and I said, hey, Have you heard anything more about on this Abrego thing or this dope connection thing? Because I keep getting little bits and pieces that start sounding like there's a lot more to it than that. He said, well, I'll see what I can find out. And he called me back, and I did a 5-page report this time. I took it back, and it implicated some people in the Texas National Guard at the very highest levels, right in the governor's office, that were involved in some of this stuff, that was feeding Abrego information. I interviewed the sheriff of Tarrant County, David Williams, and he said that they knew who Abrego was, you know. But here the FBI said the guy didn't exist. Well, about a year goes by, and I'm out in working the Amtrak derailment in Hyder, Arizona, out at the Maricopa County Sheriff's Office. I'm in Phoenix. And I came into the motel one night, and I turned the news on, and here they're pulling Juan Garcia Abrego off an airplane in Houston. The FBI has got him, and they're extraditing him out of Mexico, and they're putting him in the jail down there. I flew back. That was a Friday, and I was picking up a new helicopter for the police department in Tulsa, and I flew it back over the weekend with my partner. We got back on Sunday night. Monday morning, I go to the post office on my way to work to mail some letters and bills, and I look up, and on the wall, here's a wanted poster for a cat named Juan Garcia Abrego. It's got his picture there. Not only has it got his picture, he's on the FBI's 10 most wanted list and has been there for 2 years.
And so, obviously, somebody in the FBI had said, don't tell Craig anything about this.
That's right. And so
everything is cover up, cover up, cover up.
It was layered. It was layered on it like you were in a feedlot. I got the postmaster to give me that wanted poster and folded it up, put it in my flight suit pocket, and off I go to the FBI office. And I walk in and I said up to my guy, I said, hey, I said, do you remember this memo I gave you here about a year ago about this guy named Abrego? He says, vaguely. I said, well, read it again. So he kind of glanced at it. We were in the conference room sitting at the table, which I'm sure was bugged. And he said, yeah, I remember it. And he says, and I said, you said there wasn't anything to it, right? And he said, right. And I said, okay. He said, and I gave you this one here. It's 5 pages. I said, there's more detailed, and it talked about people in the Texas National Guard named my name and rank and what office they worked in and stuff like that. And you guys do anything with this? He says, no, there wasn't any reason to follow up on that. There really wasn't anything down there. I says, really? I said, well, how do you explain this? And I opened that wanted poster up and shoved it across the table. And I said, he's on your 10 most wanted list, and you told me this guy didn't exist. And I've been running all over the country out here doing an investigation for you, and I've been, you know, working on this case and pouring my heart out on it and staying up, you know, day and night on it, and then you turn around and lie to me. I said, don't ever do that again. And so a few weeks went by, and I caught him in another lie. So I finally just said, okay, I'm not working for these guys anymore. And so I branched off and started continuing on with the case, and I was working with people like Gina Davis and Jimmy Rothstein and some with David Hoffman and some of the others. We just formed kind of an ad hoc investigation team, but we all had one thing in common: we wanted the truth. Whether we were right wing, left wing, conservative, liberal, didn't matter. We wanted the truth, and we were going to get it. And so we started working that way. And I was the lone law enforcement officer of the bunch. And then, of course, we had an investigative journalist, and we had a news investigative journalist from Channel 4, Gina Davis. And then Jimmy Rothstein was, retired New York City detective, and he was working with us on it and so on. So we finally put together a good team that actually could get some things done. And it worked together off and on for over 2 years on this case, and we finally started putting things together. Well, recently, you may have heard about the lawsuit that has been filed by Judicial Watch under the auspices of Mike Johnson, who's a lawyer in Oklahoma City, has been off and on working with the Oklahoma City bombing case for some time now, against the country of Iraq. And everybody's asking, well, what does Iraq have to do with this thing? Well, while we were working this case, Janet Davis came up with the information about the two Arabs that were standing in front of the Murrah building holding the parking place and found out that they were Iraqi soldiers. They were Republican guards. And the John Doe 2 who got out of the truck, that we can place eyewitnesses picking him out, who were never called to trial, never called to the grand jury, but picked out this guy named Al Husseini, brought him, you know, said that's the guy that picked him out of the photo lineup and said that's the guy that was in the truck with McVeigh. She worked this end of it and found out that she had this whole cell of Iraqis in Oklahoma City working for a guy named Khalil.
Now, Chris, these people had been brought here by our government after the Gulf War.
this is what I found out when she told me about this part of it, and I started researching into this. I found out that we had brought over 3,500 former Iraqi POWs that were fought against us. These aren't friendly guys. These are guys that fought against us. These are the guys that blew up the oil fields in Kuwait, brought them into this country under Madeleine Albright's State Department, brought them into Carlisle Barracks, Pennsylvania, then ended up scattering them all over the country in 10- and 12-man cells everywhere. And the VFW wrote about it in their magazine. The DAV wrote about it in their magazine. The American Legion wrote about it. We wrote our congressman. I wrote Senator Jen Emhoff in Oklahoma. And, you know, what are we doing bringing these guys over here? These are the guys that fought against us. This is a country that leaves our own POWs behind, but we bring the enemy over and scatter them all over the place. And these guys, you know, they're bloody terrorists. And he wrote me back a nice letter. Yeah, I'm not for it, and I'm against it. But it's already a done deal, and we got to make sure it doesn't happen again. Typical political letter. And Jim's a good guy. But there's nothing he could do about it. It was too late. They were already here. And so we find out that we got this Al Husseini cat. And he was identified by eyewitnesses as coming out, as being in the cab at Johnny's Tire Store in Oklahoma City with McVeigh on the way to the Murrah Building. He was seen getting out of the truck by other eyewitnesses. He was seen in McVeigh's car leaving the parking lot with McVeigh by another eyewitness. None of these witnesses were called to trial. None of these witnesses were allowed to go to the grand jury. Interestingly enough, we found out later that this same guy, who was identified as John Doe 2, on 9/11 of last year, was working at the Logan Airport in Boston. Now, I don't know what he was doing there. And I tried to get a hold of the Port Authority police up in Boston, and I didn't have much success in convincing anybody up there what I was talking about, because they didn't know who I was, and they didn't know anything about the Oklahoma City bombing case. But I kept trying to tell them that, the guy that we had pegged as John Doe 2 is, was according to information that we received, working as a baggage handler at Logan International Airport, and this guy needs to be looked at, and here's his name. And their deal is, we don't know anything about any John Doe 2 because it was just McVeigh and Nichols as far as we're concerned, and who are you anyway? You almost have to fly up there, show them your background, show them your file, show them your credentials before they wanted to believe what you had to say. So that's as far as we could take that one. But meanwhile, we've got Nichols, and Nichols has been called back to Oklahoma, and he is going to trial for 168 homicides, which can give him the death sentence in Oklahoma, which is a totally different way he got it in federal court. He got life in prison up there. And it's going to be very interesting to see what happens now, and if this court is allowed to proceed in a normal course of events versus the two grand juries that we had that were totally manipulated. It's just going to be real interesting to see what happens now. Meanwhile, I've been called back in by some of the people working on the Iraqi thing. I volunteered my information and my files to this lawsuit, so we'll see what happens along that way as well. So it's going to get real interesting in the very near future. But the bottom line is, the last thing that we want to mention, if we had followed up in 1995 on the Philippine connection to Al-Qaeda, and then on to Osama bin Laden, and gone after those guys then, there would not have been a 9/11. We would not have lost all of these rights. We wouldn't have lost the World Trade Center and all the people in it, and we wouldn't be living under a semi-police state that we're living under now.
In other words, in the name of fighting terrorism, why we are losing our freedom, and yet we're not closing our borders. We're continuing to bring in or allow people to come into this country from nations that our State Department considers to be terrorist nations. The president firmly opposes any effort to arm the pilots on commercial airplanes. I think most Americans would really prefer to have an armed pilot rather than knowing that if their plane is hijacked, it'll be shot down by F-16 fighters. There's something wrong with everything going on here. And, of course, as you get into the background of this, you find, unfortunately, that the government has known about these terrorist cells and, in many cases, has actually promoted these terrorist cells across America, but they've concealed the truth from the American people. And I think that we're going to be in very, very serious trouble as we move towards our war with Iraq, which is coming. Well, that's a subject for another night. Anyway, our guest this evening has been Colonel Craig Roberts. His book, Killzone and the Medusa File. You won't want to miss them if you haven't read them. And you'd like more information on how to get them, you might call 1-800-544-8927, 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. And this is the time when we, of course, ask you to pray for America. to pray for revival, remembering that if we